This is the Stamfords Podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
The stage here, it's just gone 1 o'clock at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, is going to be bursting at the seams. We're going to be fuller than a butcher's dog as we go on a culinary adventure in conversation with Julia Wheeler. Please, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together and welcome to the stage Caroline Eden, Eleanor Ford, John Wright and Elizabeth Luard.
Okay. Hello and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Thank you for being here. We're at exactly the right time of the day for this session, culinary adventures. And I suspect that during our chat there'll be some wafting over probably from the stands over there. Let me introduce the panel. Elizabeth Luard is an award-winning food writer, journalist and broadcaster whose latest book is Squirrel Pie and Other Stories, Adventures in Food Across the Globe. More of that in a second. Caroline Eden and Eleanor Ford are friends and co-authors with a passion for Central Asia, and their book is called Samarkand, Recipes and Stories from Central Asia and the Caucasus. And John Wright is a naturalist and expert on fungi, who knows pretty much all there is to know about foraging in hedgerows, forests and seashores. And his latest book is A Natural History of the Hedgerow and Ditches, Dikes and Dry Stone Walls. So a very warm welcome to all of you. Wonderful array from different parts of the world, near and far. Elizabeth, let me begin with you. You say that you've spent a lifetime nosing in other people's cooking pots. What have you found?
Mostly that you have to be really nice to people in markets, and it helps if you have small children. When I first travelled without small children, I didn't realise the extent to which it was attractive. And people will come and talk to you in markets all over the world. And I was brought up in South America as a child, so I was kind of used to the Latin way of life, so I've tended to go to Latin countries. And then I discovered that the other thing that you can do is, I was a natural history painter before I was a food writer, so I carry a sketchbook and a watercolour little box on my thumb, and I can stand in a corner of a market, and I'll get lots of people in no time, and stall holders telling me what they're, you know, what's in the pot, what to take home. So I do my homework and then look at what's available, and I'm pretty sure that I will know what anybody's going to do with it. So landscape, climate, and geography basically dictates how people cook. So my first cookbook was European Peasant Cookery. And everybody thought it would be nothing but potatoes and, you know, not very nice. But this is not true.
And how much has your childhood being brought up abroad, and also you went when you were newly married and lived in Spain with your children, how much has that influenced your love of this culinary adventure?
Oh, I mean, very strongly, because I was very used to exploring other people's food. And because my mother married a diplomat, and so my brother and I were sort of not the right side of the family, which can happen. And so I spent a lot of time in the kitchen, so which was different, because diplomats abroad tend to take their own traditions, food with them. And my mother used to have tin sausages shipped over from Harrods. She also had crackers at Christmas shipped over from Harrods. And the Uruguayan authorities in Montevideo, they read what was on the box and they saw the word explosive. So they impounded the crackers and took them out to a small island in the middle of the River Plate and then blew them up. And we were all watching all this stuff like confetti going all over the place. So I was used to being an alien in foreign lands and becoming very quickly a non-alien. And the way to become a non-alien, you might like to know, folks, you probably already know this, is to eat the food. I'm sure that if we sent spies into places where it was unfamiliar territory, and before they went out, we didn't bother to teach them the language because they'll never get it. You know, you can get it, it's sort of, but you never get the accent right. And we just fed them on whatever was being eaten, wherever they were going. They just keep their mouths shut, and nobody would ever suspect anything because they'd smell right. How about that for a thought?
So let's come to your latest book, Squirrel Pie. Where did you eat squirrel pie and under what circumstances?
Where did I eat squirrel pie? Actually, in the Maine woods, but I've been inspecting the...
This is the grey squirrel.
We're not talking squirrel nutkin, you know? There are no recipes in English household books for squirrel nutkin. Only a recommendation that the fur is good for hats. And that's about it. People used to use it for collars. But the American grey is very much part of the tradition of wild game, of gathering wild game. And we ought to get rid of our greys. We all know we ought to get rid of our greys. And if we're going to get rid of our greys, we should be eating them. So there's a whole range of recipes in America. I can just point out that squirrel pie is not entirely about squirrel and quite a lot of pie, but it's not entirely devoted to squirrel. If you want to know what it tastes like, it's like young rabbit. And only the hind legs are interesting. You don't bother with kind of unzipping the entire furry little coat. It's just the hind legs that are good. They come in... Well, anyway, Squirrel Pie is the last in a series of memoirs. The first one was Family Life. Second was Still Life, which was Travels After Children. Family Life was still in print. All the memoirs, I'm happy to say, are still in print. Family Life was basically bringing my children up in Andalusia and hello birds, hello sunshine, and they went to school on a donkey, so it was all like that. And I had a daughter who was, she managed to get herself HIV positive. And she wasn't a bad girl. She didn't, you know, get it the nice way from a blood transfusion. It's just, you know, anybody who gets pregnant, it's just a bad picker. And so I was already... being a food writer in contract to do a book called Family Life, Hello Birds, Hello Sunshine. And then I just said, I can't do that anymore, until my agent couldn't do it. And then she was a journalist on the Daily Mail. She did a fashion page. She went to be a painter. And she was brought up in Spain. So she was very, you know, very sort of, she did flamenco wonderfully well. She was bilingual in French and Spanish because I took them to France as well. I'll stop talking in a moment and then other people can get a look in. And so she'd left a diary of what she'd gone through. This was 1994, where not a lot was known. So after she died, her story went into Family
right.
Life. So that started the memoirs. Still Life was after that, quite a lot of travel and food, always with recipes. And then the next one is My Life as a Wife, Love, Liquor, and What to Do About the Other Women. I haven't actually worked out what to do about the other women because my husband was a bit of a handful, no longer on the planet, so I can get away with anything now.
and this is the last one?
The fourth is Squirrel Pie, which is basically... Ethiopia, Gujarat,
it's
wherever I found myself.
Wonderful.
And
okay.
So it's story, the same format, stories about travelling with recipes on the end.
And it's beautifully woven in, so thank you.
And also my own drawings in it, so that's
yes.
why I was coming back
yeah,
to.
Yeah, yeah. So Caroline, let me come to you and to Eleanor. How lovely to be friends and co-authors. How does it divvy up between what you do in your book Samarkand?
Samarkand is collaborative work between...
Hold it a bit closer.
Collaborative work between the two of us. I'm a travel writer before I'm a food writer. I do both, but I'm really a travel writer. Eleanor is a food writer and a recipe writer and the best cook that I know. So when I came up with this idea, I said, I'd love to do this book. Who might work with me on it? And I thought they need to be very patient, first of all. And I thought of Eleanor because of her fantastic recipe writing. So together we've done this book.
And so where does your... when did you discover and how did your love affair with this region or city and this region come about? Just give us an idea of where it is and so on.
Okay, so very briefly, I've been travelling in the region since about 2009 as a journalist, and I was just really fascinated with it because I travelled a lot in India. And I started to trace the history of the Mughals back, and obviously that led me to Bukhara and Samarkand in particular. And when I was there, I thought this is a very, very intriguing region, and it's very addictive, because you sort of go to one of these countries out of the five countries of Central Asia, and you sort of want to understand more. Travel there isn't the easiest, but it's probably the most rewarding out of everywhere I've been in the world, and I do travel quite extensively for my job. And the more I saw, the more I wanted to go back. And then I went on to the Caucasus. It's a lot of Silk Road travel, so they're all linked, these countries.
And so, Eleanor, in terms of sourcing the recipes, how did you... So Caroline came back and said, it's wonderful, let's collaborate. How did you go about sourcing authentic recipes?
Well, yes, it was Caroline who introduced me to the region. We've been friends for a long time and have travelled apart and together quite a lot. And Caroline said, this is a part of the world where people don't know about the food. It's a real culinary black hole, and we should do something about this. So we chose to make Samarkand, a city in the middle of Uzbekistan, as our central hub to the book, because this is really the heart of the old Silk Road. It's where... different peoples from all around have crossed, and so you get so much culinary influence from the lots of different surrounding countries all in this melting pot of Samarkand. So I went out there and tried to get my hands around the food of the region. They don't have recipe books there. People don't tend to cook from books or write down what they're cooking. Recipes are passed from families, and it's a shared experience. There's a lot of intuition in cooking there. They'll say that to tell if rice is ready, you'll listen to the particular sound that it makes, the cheep cheep sound. So people aren't used to having recipes. There was nothing I could research that way. It had to be very hands-on. And I think, as Elizabeth was saying, young children are the best way into people's hearts when you're traveling. I took my son, who was then 1.5, with me, and he would get us into all sorts of places I couldn't on my own. So we went to kitchens, we went to bakeries, private houses, we went to the big plov canteens, and I learnt by watching and by trying, and people were so generous in sharing their stories with me.
You say in the book that you've divided the recipes up into 7 ethnic groups, some of which we might expect to be in that region. But the Koreans were one that I hadn't expected to find in there. Tell us about the history of Korean cuisine and Koreans more generally in that region.
So the Koreans are the surprising bunch of the 7 groups that we've got in the book. And the Koreans were exiled by Stalin. And about 180,000 or so ended up in Central Asia. Many of them settled in Kazakhstan, but they've sort of splintered off into most of the countries. And the Koreans are particularly interesting because if you like spicy food, like we do, that's really where you're going to find your heat. The Koreans that cook in these countries use quite a lot of pepper. They sort of do a kimchi and they do grated carrot salads, and they put quite a lot of chili in. So if you've been eating plov and shashlik and lagman and these dishes, which can all be fantastic but are not particularly spicy, the Koreans are the ones you go to for a bit of a hit of pepper. And these people have stayed on. They've not tried to go anywhere else. They've remained, and they've sort of built their homes and families there in Central Asia. And you can be at the most remote Central Asian market and you will find one of these people, the Koro Saram, selling their bags of grated carrot salads. So it's quite an interesting quirk, and it's not a group that people expect to find.
So, John, let's come to you. You're closer to home and foraging. We don't actually need to go too far to find some pretty interesting food, do we?
Oh, well, not at all. Actually, I feel I'm here under slight false pretenses because I don't even know where Samarkand is. Is it a place?
Uzbekistan.
Uzbekistan. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure if they have
I don't know where Uzbekistan is.
So it, what you better describe it, Tajikistan, Central Asia.
It's the heart of Central Asia, so it's really, in Uzbekistan is the heart, and then Samarkand's slightly off to the east, but it's really at the centre of the region, and it's in a wonderfully fertile plain. They get fresh meltwater from the Zarashan Mountains, hence why there's such wonderful fruit and vegetables available there. It's not an arid wasteland like people tend to think.
But probably not many hedges.
No, hedges...
I'm trying to think. No.
Yeah, well, hedges are something of a British, sort of English and Welsh speciality, and they're quite rare elsewhere. I mean, certain parts of France, the north and northern France, they are seen, but it's almost a wonderful and exquisite English invention. And I had quite a lot of concerns over why on earth we have hedges in the first place. You try and think about it, you think, well, why... Why are they there? Because mostly it's stop-proofing. Also land demarcation, a certain amount of privacy, protection from the wind. This is all about food. And, of course, hedges are all about food because you don't have hedges where you do not have agriculture. More directly, which is goes back to a lot of some of the other books I've written. I wrote another book with the word hedgerow in it, and that was how to find wild food in the hedgerow. And indeed, hedgerows have been a resource for people through the centuries. We are so lucky to be able to embrace other cultures' food these days, and we're so lucky, certainly in the West, on how much food there is. I mean, I'm of a certain age, and I see one or two of my contemporaries here, and we were brought up on the... I mean, it was nice food, but it was so extraordinarily dull in English. But we have it now. And in the past, of course, it was even worse. It was really some terrible subsistence farming. And most people live on almost a starvation diet. And the hedgerows, and indeed the wasteland, which was part of the common ownership, was the resource.
So people would supplement, obviously, their nutrition in that
yes,
way.
Yes, I mean, the nutrition was very poor because it was they grew corn. Their staples were, you know, protected by the hedges, were of various corns and a little bit of meat. Really, all the variety really came from their back gardens and from the wild.
Mm. But foraging has become this slightly sort of trendy, cool thing that people perceive to be very middle class.
Yes, that's a terrible thing. That's a terrible thing. It's one of my pet hates is when people say, "Oh, it's a modern fad," or worse, the most cutting remark is a middle class fad. And I think that's the most terrible thing because that is the way that people lived. I mean, if you go back before agriculture, it was the only way to obtain your food, that and hunting. And to call it a fad is an absurdity. It's like having babies, and indeed making babies in the first place is a modern fad. It's not at all.
No, by definition.
Yes.
So, Elizabeth, you've said that you are more of a gatherer than a hunter.
Yes, I was going to say to John, when I've been asking questions, particularly when I've had children around, when my own children... Is it singing? Is it okay? When I had my own children, they went to school, they walked to school, and they were in Andalusia, where there is a meter on either side of the road, which is free for the gathering. So you get olive trees, almonds, so there's a sort of hedge situation. But because they were walking with other children, they learnt what they could eat. And there was a tremendous amount of hedgerow food. So when one looks at English recipes from, let's say, a couple of hundred years ago, and you look at them and you think they weren't eating any greens, because there's quite a prejudice against eating greens, particularly starts with children. But actually the children were eating quite a lot of stuff on the way to school, and they understood it. And then suddenly everybody went to school in buses, and they lost that knowledge.
Yes, there was this... I don't really think it was lost until quite recently, because during the war years, it was perfectly normal to collect wild food. But it was almost essential to do so. And then we went through this sort of dark period in English cuisine, if I can call it that, when we got so enthralled to the supermarket, all these wonderful new things we could have, and you know, tins of stuff and frozen stuff and packaged stuff, that we thought we don't need to go out to the wild anymore because we've all got it. And we started to feel how false that was. And we had no connection to our food. We weren't necessarily growing it ourselves. It was just something that came in a packet. We rebelled, and I think the revival of foraging, which is a superb thing, because it does put you back. I mean, it's such a cliche, but it really does put you back in touch with nature. I take about 40 wild food forays every year. Mushrooms, you know, mushroom hunting down by the seaside, collecting seaweed and cockles, and hedgerows as well. And I take groups of, you know, a dozen, 15, 20 maybe, out, and you know, these people, they live in terrible places like London. They never get to see the sky and stuff. And I am joking, but And there's something happens to them. They start off the day a little bit anxious. What's going to happen to them? What, if it's going to be exciting, boring, or what? Or they're going to get cold and wet. And after about 10 minutes, that foraging instinct kicks in, and it's just glorious to see. You can see their pupils dilate. And I've actually had people in tears at the end of a day's foray. They say, "I'm not flogging these, by the way. But if you want to." Go, you know, just let me know. They just think it's the best thing because they are doing something completely natural.
So, go ahead. The foods and wild flavours are much stronger than cultivated flavours. We seem to kind of breed for blandness.
Oh, absolutely.
As soon as we can.
Yes, it's extraordinary. The power in some of the wild foods. My favourite, I don't know if you've ever come across this, it's a very common wild food, and you often find it in an urban situation. There's a marvellous patch around an industrial site in Yeovil, for example, and that is black mustard. Have you ever tasted fresh black mustard? That's the black seeds is part of mustard we buy in a pot. It's a rather coarse green leaf, and you start to chew and nothing really happens, and all of a sudden you get this wave of heat almost overpowering. It's an extraordinary experience, and we tend to lose that sort of thing.
It sounds like the sort of thing that you might like, Caroline, with your...
Oh, yes, you'd love it.
Did either of you come across, either in the sort of heritage side or actually in the recipes, foraging within the Samarkand and beyond?
Yes. I'll just talk briefly about one of the essays in the book that I particularly enjoyed writing is Foraging in the High Pamirs, which is very exotic sounding, and it was actually quite exotic. It's 7,000 metre peaks up in the High Pamirs of Tajikistan, and I was in the regional town called Horog, which is a small town, and it was sort of built as an outpost, Soviet-built place. And I met a chap there called Mr. Papi Shah, who was a wonderful man, and I had lunch with him, and he would strap on a backpack at the weekends and go up into the foothills of these great mountains and would look for things like ibex grass and dog rose and obviously apricots, like in the Hunza in Pakistan. Apricots are amazing in Tajikistan. They're absolutely everywhere. And he would bring them back to his kitchen and cook oyster mushrooms. And we ate together, and he would tell me about how he would do this. And he had a sort of medicine cabinet where he would dry herbs and would use them for all kinds of ailments and also to supplement vodka. We discovered that ibex grass goes very nice with vodka. So
he had a great nickname, didn't he?
His name's Papi Shah.
But is he the king of the mountain grass?
Yeah. Yes, he's a wonderful person. I'm hoping to go back in the summer and give him a copy of the book, because there's some photos of him in there if you see the copy.
And how much were you able to incorporate those sorts of ingredients into the recipes, given that we've got to be able to find the ingredients back here in order to cook them?
I'd say that something that strikes people as strange about the book is it's not full of unusual ingredients that you haven't heard of. Foraging aside, most of the things that are in the markets in Central Asia are just the very good fresh produce that we get here. They have amazing fruits and vegetables, spices that have got fantastic scent that you don't get here. You know, the cumin has got a much stronger flavour but it is just cumin. They don't use a huge variety of spices that we don't use. The meats and the dairy, they're very proud of. But it is just a way of combining foods, quite simply, and then without unusual exotic ingredients, and then a lot of use of fruits and nuts, even in savoury cooking. So the pilafs will be scattered with pistachios and almonds and, you know, pomegranate seeds or quince.
There's lots of pomegranates, isn't there?
There's a lot of pomegranate. Yeah. So so it's not that it's really unusual ingredients, it's just that it's...
I'm just going to interrupt because we talked about this a lot when we started the book, and somebody said to us, it's not too dissimilar from, you know, if you have a good Middle Eastern shop, basically everything that we've included in the book can be found, certainly in London. And I live in Edinburgh now, and I found, you know, it's very easy to find these ingredients. I think if you're used to Middle Eastern cooking, it's not very challenging, is it? We've purposefully set out to not make it intimidating. And
I think there is such crossover with Middle Eastern cooking in general. I mean, this is a part of the world that borders, you know, Iran. The flavours and the things are so transient. This is the Silk Road. Ideas were passing back and forth. Produce was passing back and forth, and culinary ideas were passing back and forth. So the recipes you'll see, you know, tie that whole part of the world together from east to west.
There's also, I think, situations where migration, which often we do see a lot, but then people adapt. You know, you go to the market, you come from miles away, and then you go to the market and have a look to see what's cheap and easy and looks more or less like what you're used to. So there's a whole range of recipes that can be slipped, that people have to do it.
I think what's an interesting example of that is going back to the Koreans in Central Asia that Caroline was talking about. This spicy carrot salad they sell everywhere. And it's essentially a version of kimchi. They didn't have the right cabbage in Central Asia to be able to make kimchi, which is the lifeblood of Koreans at home. And carrots are plentiful there. They've got wonderful yellow and orange carrots. They go into everything. And, the Korea Seram people adapted their spicy salads to include carrots.
But also you have to remember when Stalin dropped the borders of Central Asia in the 1920s, all these ethnic groups got scattered. So on top of the movement of people you had throughout history on the Silk Road, in the 1920s you had new borders being drawn up and different groups placed in odd places. So that alone kind of contributed a lot to the mix of different ethnic backgrounds you've got through the region. So that's also quite interesting. You've got the ancient history, but also the quite modern history playing into the mix of the different things that you find in the food, in the music, in the clothes, and in everything.
Just changing.
And the mix of the steppe and the city is the other key thing with this region. So the people out on the steppe lands are obviously dominated by meat and dairy, whereas people in the cities have greater access to all kinds of stuff, so completely different cuisine. You see it in the embroiderers. The embroiderers in the city, much more ordered gardens and things that the Afghans were very good at, beautiful gardens. And the embroideries out on the steppe that people still do will be animal horns and yurts and much more, you know, of their direct environment. So the mix is particularly interesting. Soviet and Islamic, that's the key mix.
Okay. So let's come back to foraging, but foraging of a different type, snails in Crete. Tell us about your adventure there, Elizabeth.
Well, I've noticed that every single cookbook I've ever written has got a recipe for snails in it. So it's obviously a... the idea was that this was the ideal Mediterranean diet. It's where the whole kind of thinking that Mediterranean, that was what everybody ought to be doing. Very little meat, some fish, bit of dairy, but mostly greens and grains. And the work on this was done pretty much by a figure called Ansel Keynes just after the war, when it was noticed in the hospital in Naples that although the Cretans had been fighting in the war, he was a heart specialist, Ansel Keys. And he noticed nobody was in need of that particular skill if they were Cretan. So the interesting thing being that suddenly there might be a diet that would be very good for health. So off he went to Crete and took a look and asked a lot of questions, went back to America. The Smithsonian sent a whole lot of more experts, and they asked a lot of questions. Now, there's a funny thing about wild food, which is that you eat further down the food chain as in when you are poor or when there's war, and nobody wants to remember that. So the questions that you're asking can be very intrusive, or they can, people won't want to say anything. You know, they won't want to say, yes, we ate that. So the same thing seemed to have happened with snails on Crete. Snails on Crete are completely wonderful. Anybody who's ever eaten snails on Crete will know they're really delicious. They're great big fat snails. A lot of them are now exported to France to be eaten with garlic butter, which the Cretans think is completely stupid. Why would you want to eat a perfectly nice snail with garlic butter when it tastes delicious with peppercorns and fennel and that kind of thing? And it was a resource that neither the Germans, who were resident, nobody else wanted to eat it. The English didn't want to eat it, Americans didn't want to eat it, the Germans didn't want to eat it. And the Cretans realized that if they said, no, we didn't just eat grains and greens, we ate snails. And I was told, yes, we ate snails, when I got kind of deep into it, 4 or 5 times a week. So that is very high protein, a high protein source, which made complete nonsense of all the questions that the Smithsonian experts were asking. It wasn't so much the snails themselves, it was the fact that there was a protein source that nobody else wanted to eat, and which you could very easily gather, and which was, it cropped usually under the olive trees. And the point is, and vines. So the point is, as long as you knew what the snail had eaten, you didn't even have to starve it, because it was only the whatever it had eaten that was ever going to be not good. And then you salt and you rinse and you salt and you rinse and you get rid of the slimy bit that everybody... I always wondered why we didn't eat slugs. Anybody eaten slugs? Anybody here eaten snails? No?
They're too bitter, I understand.
Slugs, yeah,
slugs,
no, they,
yes,
might be.
Very nasty,
they might be.
Very nasty.
Yeah, I thought there must be some reason. Yeah,
I'm researching another foraging book at the moment, and I wanted to put in things like snails, and I got this wonderful idea of midges. If anybody spends any time around Loch Lomond, they know all about midges. And I was going to put a very thin net on the top of my pickup truck, and just drive around until I catch a load of midges and then make a sort of midge pate out of it. I don't know what it's going to be like, but it's going to be very high protein.
You're going to need an awful lot of midges, aren't you?
Well, there are a lot of midges around Loch Lomond. You have no shortage of them. It's insects. But I was also going to incorporate, I'm stealing myself to incorporate garden snails, which are just as edible as the large...
All snails are edible.
All
land snails, all
as
sea snails.
As far as
snails.
I know, all... Yes, as far as
no,
I know.
No, they are.
Oh, okay.
I've done a lot of work on snails.
Oh, well done,
you,
yeah.
Me.
Okay, I'll be
I've
in touch.
I've eaten a lot of
I'll
snails.
Yes, I'm going to have purify some garden snails and see what they taste like. I'm sure they'll be very nice. I must have borrowed this joke from somebody else. It's Miles Irving, a fellow forager, and he suggested making a dried sausage out of snails.
No.
And he said, no, he's going to call it salimi.
No, it's
a terrible joke. It wasn't my joke, it's Miles Irving. So
you're shaking your head at that. How should we eat them?
Well, basically, all you have to do is get to them to a point where they are, the texture is quite like ox heart. And in fact, if in France, that's what's used if you can't get real snails. So snails will take on whatever. That's why they're so good with garlic butter. So it's the initial cooking. And in Spain, in Andalusia, in May, June, snails aestivate. Most snails hibernate. They go underground in the winter and you have to dig them out. In Spain, because it's very hot in Andalusia, they aestivate. They climb up thistles. It happens to be an edible thistle, Scolopax hispanicus. And they, therefore, whatever they've eaten is not going to do you any harm, but also the fact that they're self-starved. So you don't gather them till June, till after the rains. And then you'll see people with buckets and sticks, including me and my children. And they're little tiny snails with very pretty cream and brown patterns on the shells. And you clean them off, salt and water and salt, till they stop fizzing. It's called la baba, which is quite descriptive. And then you cook. You go to the market, to the lady with the spices, and you say, I want some snail spices. And she says, how many kilos have you got? And you say, 5. And then she gives you a screw with chili, black pepper, cumin, and seed coriander. And then that's what you flavor them with. You bring them to the boil, very gently, so they poke their little heads out. How about that? And then you skim them with pennyroyal, which always grows with the snails. It's a whole system.
It's a whole system.
And that is the basic thing. If you do that with any size snail, just bring them gently to the boil, cook them, skim off the foam, and then they're ready to cook them in anything you want. You can have them in a... the Italians like them in a tomato sauce. There are, as I say, the Spaniards like them just in the broth, or they do them with chili and tomato sauce, maybe with some chorizo or something. But it's not something... It's a food sauce. It's nothing to be afraid of. You don't have to dry them.
I have eaten them once. I must admit it was at the Fat Duck. I used to take them out, take the chefs out on free forays in return for a meal. So I had Heston's famous snail porridge. Actually, it was the nicest thing there, funnily enough.
Talk us through snail porridge by Heston, then.
A pinhead, like a pinhead oatmeal in a nice stock, and with bits of snail floating around in it. It was better than it sounds.
It'd Why was be, it the nicest it? Thing? What was the flavour?
Oh, I can't remember. It was just edible.
I'm just looking for another snail recipe, is all. You know what I mean?
There are. You've got a recipe in your book. Are there any questions that anybody would like to ask, or any funny things that they've eaten that they'd like to share, or thoughts about foraging, or if you come up with anything, just stick up your hand and we'll get. There we go. We've got a question there. There's a microphone just there.
Only to add that I have had snails in paella, in land in Spain, instead of shrimps and all the rest of it.
It's very classic. Snail paella is... it's because a paella is it's an outdoor food.
Mm. Yeah.
You know that big pan that you get it in? Well, the tradition is to cook it on an open fire. It's considered that men always do the cooking. Mm. And wild gathering... An element of wild gathering. I mean, when my children were in Spain, we used to... they used to go out with their school friends, everybody crammed into a tiny little Seat, you know, Fiat 600, with the paella pan on the back and granny and the chicken on the back seat, masses of children, and everybody went off actually into the mountains rather than by the sea, and you had to gather crayfish from the stream, rabbit from the hill, and snails. And they all went in with the rice. And if you got enough, the chicken went home. And if you didn't, the chicken went in the pot. It was very practical.
Very practical.
Did you actually like it, by the way?
What, the paella?
It was delicious. I was asked by a group of Spanish businessmen. We were going off to have lunch somewhere. And on the way, they said, do you like paella? I said, yes. Right, we drove on a bit further. Do you like rabbits? I said, I love rabbits. Yeah. A bit further on. What about snails? Are you snails? Good, good. Where we're going, we're going to have real paella. And it was up in the mountains somewhere.
Ooh. Was this Valencia?
20-30 miles inland from Alicante.
Alicante, so yeah. Sort of Valencia area. Yes. Yeah. It used to be because there was a rice-growing area around Valencia, the mouth of whichever river it is. So the snails would be gathered there, and the rabbit, and so it's basically a sort of edible travelogue, a good paella.
Has anybody else got any questions about what they might like to... Go on, Roddy, you've got a...
I've got a nosy question, because I love cooking, and usually, in my experience, people who, like you, who are so good with recipes, have a tip that they're evangelical about, you know, like, people, we cook onions too quickly. Do you have something that I can go home and try tonight?
Yeah, let's... Start with you two. Go on, Eleanor. We'll put you on the spot. Or perhaps you've got a recipe in there that people might like to go and try tonight.
Okay, well, I think that there's one recipe we've got to talk about if we're talking Central Asian food. And it was Elizabeth talking about the paella pan outside and a large pan that only a man can cook. That is exactly the same as plov, which is... the signature dish of Central Asia.
Just describe plov
now,
for us.
This is cooked in a very large pan. It's called a kazan. And it is the root word of plov is similar to pilaf. So it's a rice dish. But it's cooked in layers. So at the bottom layer, you'll have some very slowly cooked meat. It's often lamb or beef, and it's stewed until it's tender. The next layer, you have vegetables. Carrots are always in there. It will have often onion. You might have slices of quince, something like that. It depends on the seasons. And just a little bit of spice, not much, a little cumin, a little red pepper, and then rice on the top. So this is all cooked in one dish, and it is cooked with the steam of the meat is coming up and it's scenting the rice above. And so it'll all be ready. It's not stirred together. It's cooked in its separate layers. It's the perfect one-pot dish to try at home because you don't need to be worrying about getting all sorts of different things, pans out and coordinating. It's done together. And then you serve it in reverse. Very little washing up. You serve it in reverse. You take your big pan to the table. It doesn't have to be a giant kazan. You can do it in a little casserole pot. You take it to the table, and then you'll serve it in reverse. So you'll put your rice onto the plate, then your vegetables, and a little chunk of, you know, very tender meat on the top.
Fantastic. So is there something, John, that that we may not eat tonight, but if we're able to gather at the moment or soon we'll be able to?
Well, I am very evangelical about seaweed, which isn't mentioned much in the Hedgerow book, you won't be surprised to hear, but I collect a lot of seaweed from the Dorset coast or wherever I am by the sea, I will collect seaweed. They are not hard to identify. They are incredibly good for you. My favourite is dulse. Has anybody here eaten dulse? You guys have eaten dulse. Anybody? Such gentlemen at the front. A few. Oh, that's good. You like it? It's great. It's great stuff. It's a purple frond. It's like the Latin name is Palmaria palmata, and it is indeed palm hand like. It's the most, hate the word, but approachable of all the seaweeds. It cooks up a little bit like a cabbage if you just steam it. It goes from purple to green instantly gets hot. It's very high in iodine, very high in the good proteins. I eat it almost every day. What I do is I actually dry it, and it's best to dry it in an oven at about 90 degrees. That slightly cooks it, and then I dry it till it's crispy, and I stick it in an industrial blender blitzer that I've got. Apparently, you can drop an iPhone in this thing, and it will just disintegrate. Best thing to do with iPhones, in my opinion. And I get this very fine powder, and it goes in everything. You know, even in proper English food like spaghetti bolognese and chicken tikka masala. And it actually it's a flavour enhancer because of the glutamates. And you get all these extra nutrients. I've got daughters in university up north, and I send them little packets of it, little bottles of it. I say whatever, because they seem to be living on a cocktail and pizza diet. I say, for God's sake, sprinkle them on your pizza so you get some nutrients. Seaweed, you'll love it.
Are you a fan of seaweed?
Yeah, yes, I am. I think it's a tremendous resource. I used to gather it on mull and use carrageen to set a jelly, but I also used it to thicken soup. And so
It's a thickening agent.
But actually, I think all seaweeds are edible, aren't they? Some are just chewy.
Yes, you don't have the problem you do with the mushrooms, where you can end up, you know, not just in A&E, but in a hole in the ground. And indeed, with a lot of the plants, it's really dangerous plants in this country, but none of the seaweeds are poisonous. There's one deep water kelp called Desmestia, which contains very mysteriously high levels of sulfuric acid. Basically, if you're seaweed tastes of sulfuric acid, then just stop eating it.
It just doesn't taste very nice, it's not going to do anything to you. So, I mean, a wild food that you can't mistake for anything else sounds like a rather good idea, doesn't it?
It's a great start. You have to be a little bit careful which beach you go to. You know, if it's my friend Caroline Davy, I think, collects seaweed down in Cornwall, she has to be careful not to be near a tin mine because arsenic is absorbed by the seaweed. But most seaweed's okay.
Culinary adventures, indeed, dangerous seaweed, approachable seaweed, and so on. Who knew? Thank you so much for coming and sharing your adventures. All of the panellists are going to be over at Stanford's stands. Pick up a copy of their book. They are beautiful books. Samarkand and Squirrel Pie have both got recipes in there that are wonderful and accessible. Go home, cook, eat them. Thank you very much to you for coming. Thanks to the panel.